You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hi, I'm Mike Peskin for Leonard Lopate. It's a play about microbiology with an undercurrent of sexuality, or it's a play that includes a few in-depth lectures on computer theory and the traveling salesman problem, leavened by the occasional seduction. Also, it's funny. Completeness is the new play written by Itamar Moses, starring Aubrey Dahler and Carl Muller or Miller?
It's Miller.
I thought it was Miller. Someone wrote Muller. At the Playwrights Horizon, playwright and actor are here with me now. Hey, Carl. Hey, Itamar. How are you guys?
Well, thank you.
Excellent.
Itamar, were you a science enthusiast going in?
Not in the sense that I'm like a science person or like I studied a lot of science, but I think that writers and artists often are drawn to scientific ideas because they so often, like at the deepest level, operate as like really interesting metaphors. So yes, in the sense that I like to read about science and I find it like evocative and cool,
and so you probably come across a lot of things that operate as metaphors. What was the – and there are a few things – well, let's put it this way. So much of the dialogue and text is subtext in this play, mm-hmm. that we're talking about a computer scientist who's working on a problem. We're talking about a microbiologist who's working on a problem of essentially proteins connecting, and they're trying to connect with each other. So right. We get that. But what was the central of the problems in the play? What was the one that you first hit upon that you said, maybe I could build a play around this?
Where it began for me was with the computer science problem that you mentioned, the traveling salesman problem, which I came across I think when I was in college, and I didn't really understand it, but I liked that there was this intractable unsolved problem in computer science called the traveling salesman problem.
Right,
there was something
exactly.
Almost poetic about it. And then when I came across it again years later and actually looked at it closely enough to understand what it was, I won't go into too much detail about it, but basically it's a problem in which it seems very easy because all you have to do is find the shortest path between a set number of cities, which is not doesn't even seem like a math problem. And it's not really. The problem is that every time you add a city, the number of possible paths among them increases, and they increase faster and faster and faster and faster. It's an exponential curve. And so very quickly, the problem's impossible to solve. And so that idea that faced with too many choices, one will be paralyzed, seemed to have a very obvious and strong sort of metaphorical application to like the choices we make in life. So I had sort of long suspected that there was a play in that, also because dramatic writing in particular and dramatic action and character has so much to do with choice and watching people make choices, that I thought there was a play in there for some time. But it was a very long time before it occurred to me what that play might be.
Did you write
be.
Other plays in between?
First of all, it was an idea that sat in my head for a long time before I began it. And then it was a play that I have notes from it going back as far as like 2005. And
are there other things like that, by the way, in your notes? Do you have a file, a literal file?
No.
So this was the thing that has been percolating with you for the longest time.
I wouldn't say that, but I mean, basically, it's how it always works. It's like a front burner, back burner thing,
right,
where you have ideas that you're the ones you're actively working on, and then other stuff sort of floating in the ether, and then it rotates, and eventually something feels done, and you bring
and
it
do
out.
You come back to it and say, if I keep coming back to it, there must be something there, or do you have to get the spark that turns it into drama?
Well, both. It is the spark that turns it into drama that keeps bringing you back.
Yeah. How about you and science, Carl? Science guy?
Oh gosh. Science is one of those things. Science and math. I had some natural talent for it, but it wasn't something I really enjoyed doing. And I went to one of those like powerhouse high schools where they convinced you if you didn't know AP calculus, you were going to die poor and lonely. And so I lived in fear of it all. And now you know, as an actor, you get to be this like sort of lazy dilettante about it all and just sort of sample it and enjoy it. So no, I'm not a science guy. I'm fascinated by it, but
what was the drama club like at that powerhouse school?
Well, that was the good thing, was that everything was kind of hardcore, and so it was a great little corner there.
Where was it? Where'd you grow up?
Iowa, out in West Des Moines, Iowa.
Say no more.
Yeah.
Now I thought your character at first was one of these high IQ, low EQ, you know, low emotional quotient kind of guys. But then as I saw him more, I said, he's got good insight into emotion. He just doesn't express it maybe kindly. I mean, how do you view him on the IQ, EQ question?
Well, EQ is just another metric, isn't it? I mean, I think
that's someone with a high IQ talking.
Well, or I think it's just what. Yeah, you have to fess up to the fact that
this Carl Mueller's a smart guy.
Yeah, this Mueller guy.
God, we got him instead. No, I don't know. I think. I mean, I'm instinctively going to find like the EQ territory because that's what's more interesting to me. And I think it's easy to fake being smarter than you are than it is to fake obviously being emotionally connected. And so I think it's not that Elliot has like a low EQ. I think he's still in that place where desire itself is a really terrifying thing, and so anything that provides a shortcut is appealing to him. But yeah, I don't know, I wouldn't say he's emotionally stunted or anything like that.
Is there reading back to the science, the first time you read any one of the long speeches where you explain a computer concept, did you get it immediately? Did you have to read it a few times so you understood it?
No, I think that's all a credit to Itamar, is that like he takes these things and it peels off very nicely. I think it all comes out in a coherent way, and yeah, very easy to comprehend. And again, I mean, the traveling salesman problem is a beautiful problem because it is so sublime and simple. So yeah, I think it's pretty easy to comprehend.
And of course, the motivations of the characters, they want to explain things to usually another very bright character, so they don't have to necessarily dumb things down, but they're not talking to a peer or someone who understands them. In that way, maybe they're a stand-in, the characters they're explaining it to are a stand-in for the audience. I explained it to someone like, the science is in-depth, it's not dumbed down, it's not popularized or made easy, it's like, you know, a 200-level class at a pretty good college. It's not supposed to be over your head. The professor's trying to connect with you, but still you got to do a little work. So was there a choice in that?
Yeah, I mean, you actually outlined it pretty well, because there's sort of two things going on. You can't have someone explain something at length on stage to someone else who already understands it, because the audience just won't go along with it. They'll see through it, and they'll say, well, this speech is in fact for my benefit, not for the benefit of the other person.
As you know,
stage.
We've been working this case
right
here.
Right, or the sort
Thank
of classic
basal exposition.
Yeah, as you know, we're brothers and you were the best man at my wedding. Right, exactly. So you can't do that, which is why it was necessary to always couch it with people in slightly different fields. But I also think that the audience can tell. I think different people fall different spots on this spectrum, but I'm a firm believer in the fact that the audience overall, the audience will appreciate it if you give them credit and don't hold their hand. You don't want people to be lost and confused to an extent where they become, you know, they start to reject what they're watching. But I think on the whole, I never regret giving the audience more credit, and I always end up regretting giving them not enough credit.
And you could probably say that if someone listening to this interview says, well, I don't like or get science, sub in anything. An architect passionate about flying buttresses, or, you know, a classical scholar. It doesn't matter what the subject is. It matters the acting, and it matters the context.
Yeah. And also, on top of which, I'd say that as many interesting scientific details as I came across when I was working on the play, you can't include all of them. Just because something's interesting doesn't mean it's relevant. And so I think a lot of working on the play, even just through previews here in New York, was paring back on anything that didn't also seem to carry some sort of, like you said, emotional subtext or metaphorical weight.
But the dialogue includes things that you couldn't have known. So did you talk to scientists or just consult reference books?
Both. And actually, especially with the molecular biology, which I knew even less about when I started the play, because obviously I'd been reading about the traveling salesman problem already, ultimately became necessary to talk to molecular biologists. And they were very helpful, not only in the sheer information, but talking to the people in the field gives you an idea of how they talk about what they do and the little jokes they have and the little inside, you know, shortcut abbreviations they have for things. All that stuff is really useful to know.
So playing a role, playing a scientist, you know, well, first of all, sometimes an actor has a lot of interplay with the playwright and sometimes they don't. What was it like on this play?
Oh, we can't stand each other.
Because you did this in, it was first staged in California, and you were in the California production.
Yeah, yeah.
So you've been with this play for a while. So have you talked with Itamar a lot about it?
Oh, yeah.
A fair amount, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I think I had one of the longest phone conversations I've ever had with an actor.
We spent Hurricane Irene.
We were on the phone for 2 hours that day talking about that. Because we lost some, we had our performances were all canceled that weekend. And we just spent about 2 hours. If that gives you an idea, we spent 2 hours on the phone that day.
Heck, if I was going to relax during that time, we spent the whole time talking about all the intricacies of the story. And I was just drawn to the TSP stuff, the traveling salesman stuff, in my own spare time as a something fascinating.
He did. He actually made attempts to solve the traveling salesman problem.
one of the great unsolved problems.
Yeah, why not?
Math.
Right? Yeah. Right. No,
they say an actor will solve it. I think it was
they do.
Predicted.
Well, they say some unknown amateur will solve it. And yeah. That's my qualification. So
this is Mike Pesca in for Leonard Lopate. We're talking to Itamar Moses, who's the playwright behind Completeness and the star of Completeness. Carl Miller, who hopefully won't be that unknown and is certainly not an amateur in his portrayal as the lead. Before the dialogue even starts, so we talk a lot about dialogue, there are four or five laughs just based on your actions, Carl, what Elliot is doing at the computer. If I read the stage directions, would most of what we see, obviously you bring it to life no matter what's written, but is it all in the stage direction that the funny stuff he does?
Some of it. The fact that there's sort of a computer freeze and he has to restart the computer and then he leaves and then he comes back and the whole, yeah, there's a... most of that is in there. There's a couple little flourishes that are specific to this production because you just sort of discover things. Yeah. But yeah, no, there's this conscious attempt. I'm actually very proud of that. There's like five laughs in this play before anybody talks.
Yeah. And the talking, the memorizing of the dialogue, is it different from dialogue that's based in normal everyday human speech? The science stuff.
That's a fantastic question. I think this is a Itamar's got a fusion of naturalistic dialogue and rather heightened subject matter, but not just heightened subject matter, but also it's heightened in the way it's all put together. So like you have to sort of take breath support that you would ordinarily devote and say, like, in all seriousness, like a Shakespearean speech.
I wrote that down.
Yeah, yeah. And because it comes in whole thoughts and paragraphs, and the architecture of the way the thoughts fit together is all very important, and that all makes it frankly easy to memorize because it has an integrity and a logic to it.
And then I try to throw in some like impossible to understand sex puns just to make it more like Shakespeare.
Yeah, you're spinning a few plates at the same time. But
and then when you exited Chased by a Bear, it was kind of weird to have a bear there. But then there's the dialogue that is the characters talking about their emotions. And they have this, you know, articulate inarticulateness. There's a lot of use resting on pronouns, never saying words like relationship or love. But the word that gets said a lot. And it's great dialogue. It's naturalistic. The contrast between the confidence that the biologist and the computer scientist have when talking about their subject and the lack of confidence they have when talking about their love life is stark. And I'm certain that that's something that you were going for.
Yeah, no, I mean, you literally described something that's in my very early notes about the play, which is that I thought part of the fun of it and part of the engine of it would be how exactly what you said, but like, and also how detailed and accurately you can describe things in science, and then how often language fails us when we talk about the personal stuff. Although once you get really esoteric with the science, language fails us there too, which I think is one of the interesting things. Like the biology in particular, she describes repeatedly as messy.
Huge signal to noise problem. That was her problem. That's how the characters meet. She has a lot of data and she needs to see what's the signal and what's the noise.
Exactly.
And that's sort of like a relationship. What's just a fling and what is meaningful and what's even just a flirtation and what could be followed up on.
Right. So as with any sort of stark either or question, is it the science or the feelings? The only answers are always some combination of both and neither, you know.
This is your only play I've seen. I've read about a couple of the other ones. You wrote a play called Back, Back, Back about baseball, and it took place in sort of a 9-inning format, and Bach at Leipzig was described as fugue-like in its structure. Do you set up challenges for yourself in terms of play structure?
No. I try to find the structure that makes it, the easiest. It's more, for me, the mirroring between the form and the content is more about fighting against arbitrariness, that like you want everything in a play to feel right, but you're always sort of grasping towards that and you don't know what that is. And something about making certain formal decisions, you're giving yourself certain structural boundaries that emerge directly from what the play is about, has a way of sort of gravitationally drawing what is relevant into that play. And also, I'm never picking a structure. It's not like with Bach at Leipzig, which people say is structured like a fugue. That's not actually how I describe it. It's actually structured like a particular kind of play, like a comedy of manners or a farce. And I simply sort of gently point out that structure is inherently fugue-like. So it's more about finding structures that are already storytelling structures, and dramatic storytelling is much closer to music than it is to something like the novel anyway, in that case, or in this case to a computer program, which are often literally called scripts. So,
well, perhaps related to form and structure, there is a jarring occurrence in the second act, which I won't reveal. I will speak of it only as the jarring occurrence. And I'm sure this dialogue happened. Someone said to you, you don't need it. And I'm sure you answered, it's not about needing it. It's a question of what? What did you say?
I don't know. Go on. What did I say? Yes. Carl and I had this conversation recently that it's a play about, on one level, it's a play about the fact that you can't know everything, either in the science or in what's going to happen to you in your personal life, in your relationships. And so writing a play, like you, I won't go into too much detail about it, but it has to do with...
Well, you feel free to.
Yeah.
You give it all.
Well, no,
but
I don't want to. Yes, but yes. But it does have to do with, say, the live theatrical event not unfolding, seemingly not unfolding exactly the way that it's supposed to. And I think writing a play that is about... the dead ends we hit in love or in our work, and then writing a play that sort of is designed to work quote unquote perfectly from beginning to end is a kind of a lie. That if I were to convey, there's something fascistic almost about an entertainment that works perfectly, and in a way it doesn't allow the audience in, not in the way that it felt like this play needed to, given what it was about. So yes, that conversation was had, and we tried different little tricks in the play a number of different ways, but yeah, I'm sort of happy with where we landed, because it feels important.
Carl, do you get to watch the audience during that moment?
No, I don't. It's a great regret of mine. And I don't get to watch the other two actors try and navigate it, but I don't know. I take a broader view and think that, I mean, jarring moment. We're all being so opaque about
it. The jarring occurrence, yeah.
At the end of the day, I don't think it's any weirder than an intermission in the middle of a play, which is a highly artificial, strange thing, and wonderful
for
that.
For people cheating towards the audience, or, you know, never turning your back, or
Well,
like
sure,
this.
That relationship, especially
it's
in a comedy.
It's all artifice. People have learned their lines in a play.
Exactly.
Like this.
Yeah. Well, yeah, these I mean, when you break it down, points. Yeah, but as far as conventions go and specific ruptures that take place between the two, it's all the more heightened in a comedy, obviously, where there's a very particular kind of emotional relationship with the audience, through the laughter and the feedback loop that starts. And so it's all fair game as far as I'm concerned, I think.
Yeah,
it's just
exactly.
Another version of all that.
And now I'll give you a chance to butter up the New York audience. How's it different from the California audience?
How is it? You know, there's a fabulous silence, like a sort of shrink-wrapped silence that encases everything in a New York audience, where it's not to say that they're not as into it or that they're not laughing as much. They totally are. It's that there's like this extra second where it tapers off even faster. I don't know how else to describe it. Maybe it's just the acoustics in the theater, but like it feels like a cultural thing where the emotions and the reactions don't sort of splay out. They shrink back up again. It's weird. That's the best way I can describe it. But I'm glad you asked.
It's one of the great unsolved problems in audience dynamics.
Yeah.
Carl Miller, star of Completeness, Itamar Moses. He wrote the play. It's playing at Playwrights Horizons through September 25th. Thank you guys both for coming in.
Thank you.
My pleasure.